Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Just what exactly is the West policy approach on Ukraine? Should Kyiv negotiate a peace, or should it fight on indefinitely? And what is NATO's endgame? What does winning mean? Meanwhile, despite sanctions, Russia is creating political facts on the ground. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Nebojsa Malich in Washington. He's a blogger and columnist. In Lake Jackson, we have Daniel McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And in Brussels, we have Pierre-Emmanuel Tumman. He is a lecturer at Lyon, the university. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I'm calling this program Walk Back, and you'll know why after I read this quote. I'm going to go to Daniel first. This is Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State. The people and government of Ukraine, led by President Zelensky, must decide on their own the issue of the possibility of territorial concessions. Daniel, what a change in tone and tenor and direction. Your thoughts?
Well, they're saying the quiet part out loud. I mean, it's hard to imagine either they're stupid or evil, maybe a little bit of both, but it's hard to imagine they didn't understand this back then at the beginning, you know, on February 24th. If the U.S. intelligence community weren't able to inform our diplomats that this was going to happen this way, then we're spending $20 to $30 billion a year on intelligence in vain, and we're wasting our money. But, you know, Peter, this is what always happens in Washington. These people live in a bubble. They listen to each other. They get high on their own supply constantly, and they believe the lies that they tell each other. Any voices like yours or mine or your other guests that are on this show are absolutely drowned out. Even people like Colonel McGregor, who was right from the beginning, always completely drowned out. They don't want to hear a counter narrative, because this isn't about foreign policy diplomacy. It's about building a narrative and maintaining it at all costs until it disintegrates, which it started to do, Peter, a couple of weeks ago in the mainstream media. And then they say, oh, gosh, no one saw this coming.
Okay, Nebojsa, the same thing, because, you know, I think it was in the over a course of 10 days, or something like 10 days, where we had the head of NATO saying, Ukraine should demand Crimea back, and then within 10 days to say, well, you know, about negotiate, well, that's up to Kyiv. No one's going to pressure Kyiv here after it's been a client state for 8 years of NATO. I mean, you can't talk out of both sides of your mouth at the same time. Go ahead and watch it.
Well, obviously, NATO thinks they can, and they do every day. I would agree with Daniel that this was entirely predictable from day one, but I would strike a slightly contrarian tone here and say that we're reading too much into their statements, because what they're saying is not necessarily that, you know, they want Ukraine to make concessions. What they're saying is that Ukraine has the blank check to do whatever it wants, and the U.S. and NATO will back it unconditionally, as they have been for the past 3 months. Obviously, the solution to this has always been, from day one, to negotiate in good faith. But the government in Kyiv is incapable of this. This is a fact. This is an established fact. And so saying so now, you know, after it's way too late, isn't going to change anything. But I keep hearing the same, you know, Blinken's statement, you know, it's up to Ukrainians. He's always been saying it's up to Ukrainians. That's the thing. And everybody believes that Ukraine has agency. But this is a government that's literally being funded, like underwritten by the U.S. taxpayers, just like the regime in Afghanistan that collapsed at minus 2 weeks. His whole notion that Ukraine is the one in the driver's seat making decisions and the U.S. and NATO are there to back them up is, first of all, completely upside down. And secondly, it doesn't really correspond to reality on the ground. So is it Washington who wants to make concessions? If they are, they need to say so. I don't think they're saying so.
Yeah, Pierre-Emmanuel, the thing is, like, politically and ideologically, they can't say to Kyiv, make concessions. After all of the investment, you know, I don't live in the U.S., but what is it, like $7 a gallon right now, no baby food, and, you know, and they've actually painted themselves into a corner. And by saying, you know, it's up to the Ukrainians, it's up to Zelensky, well, that's one way to say, well, it's their fault, too. They're playing the blame game already. Go ahead, in Brussels.
Yes, well, I think because it's a proxy war between the NATO member states and Russia, with Ukraine as a front state, They push Ukraine to weaken Russia during this conflict. But doing so, more and more, they are losing the economic battle on the one side, on the military battle, because the Ukrainian army, although they received a lot of weapons from NATO member states, they cannot defend properly their territory. And we can expect Russia to take over the rule of Donbass, and maybe more. The more we wait, the more Russia will rise, probably the stakes and the negotiation will be much more difficult.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, the longer this goes on, let me go back to Daniel and Lake Jackson here. I mean, we'll maybe learn in the future, but there was a point of inflection at Istanbul. And apparently what the media is reporting is that Boris Johnson told the Zelensky, no, you're not. You're not going to negotiate here. And ever since then, again, this is alleged. We don't have we need to have it all corroborated. But Daniel, at that point, I think the Russian side said, well, what's the point in negotiating with you people? First of all, you didn't implement Minsk 1 or 2. Why should we believe you now? I think this is one of the big misconceptions in Western media. I mean, do you think Russia is particularly interested in listening to what Zelensky has to say about anything at this point? Daniel.
Well, the funny thing is we had 4 years of the Democrats in the U.S. And a lot of European leaders believing that somehow Trump was Putin's agent. But literally, if Putin was the greatest spy master in history, he could not have had agents as fantastic as he has right now. And let's just look at the economic front, because oil has skyrocketed, obviously, mostly because of sanctions, but also because of supply problems and domestic U.S. energy policy. Oil has skyrocketed, and Russia is selling on the world market at a 30% discount, and people are lapping it up. I think China has purchased a 67% increase in Russian oil. Literally, Russia last month made $20 billion in revenue from oil sales that month alone. They are literally financing and funding their war on the back of U.S. sanctions. How is that for running agents in the West? It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, Nebojsa, I mean, that's one of the most incredible things that I've seen in my lifetime, how the Europeans particularly have undercut themselves. I mean, it was Chancellor Schultz, which I refer to as Sergeant Schultz on this program. He said, well, sanctions are not supposed to impact us negatively, as if he was surprised. OK, that's why we call him Sergeant Schultz. Go ahead in Washington.
Well, I mean, the European Union, I'm making a distinction between it and the continent, have committed economic suicide, and they're in the process of committing political suicide as well. The American empire, on the other hand, has managed to consolidate rule over Europe and a couple of satellites in the Pacific, but has literally antagonized the rest of the world. They keep talking about international community. Well, you don't hear that much anymore, because it's obvious to everybody that, quote, the international community is basically the US, Canada, NATO, and like Australia and South Korea and Japan. I mean, that's it. That's all, folks. So in every respect, strategic, tactical, operational, political, diplomatic, economic, this conflict has been a total disaster for the West. And obviously, the Ukrainians are the ones, you know, doing most of the dying here. And then you have the Dutch prime minister of a country that hasn't, you know, won a war in centuries, going, oh, yes, we are at war with Russia and Russia must lose. And so we must give Ukraine all the weapons. I'm like, Mark, do you have any idea what you're talking about? Of course not, because there's no accountability. There's no consequences. They're completely insulated of this. The politicians are. Their people are suffering, but the politicians don't care, because what are you going to do? Vote them out? That never works.
Yeah, but and also, Nebojsa, if I can stay with you here, sanctions hasn't changed Russia's quote-unquote behavior, okay? I mean, so you can throw in all these weapons all you want, but it doesn't change the outcome here. And then you have the problem of where these weapons go, and there's a lot of pockets being filled in Kyiv. The big story before all this for Democrats, I'm sorry, for Republicans, was just how corrupt Ukraine was. All of a sudden, that story doesn't count here. Pierre Emmanuel in Brussels, I mean, the outside of the Ukrainians, I mean, Europe is the biggest loser in all of this, not Russia.
Exactly. Because European Union member states, in particular France and Germany, missed a huge opportunity. to decide on their own future. And when the Americans didn't want to negotiate a new European security arrangement with Russia because of NATO enlargement, they wanted to keep the gate open to NATO enlargement in the future. France and Germany, which are supposed to be opposed to this enlargement anyway, didn't do a good negotiation. They didn't promise Russia not to enlarge NATO to Ukraine. They could have signed a bilateral or trilateral treaty, Franco, German, Russian. They didn't do it because they are considered the European project as a subproduct of the Euro-Atlantist project. And this is led by NATO and United States to contain Russia. But also, European Union is more and more divided because you can have you have two sides now. France, Germany, Italy still are Atlantic governments, but they would like a negotiated outcome of this conflict. But Baltic countries and Poland, they would like Ukraine to win that conflict, which is totally impossible. And for example, they are going to Kiev. Macron, Scholz, Draghi, but they are not going to negotiate anything. To be efficient, they should do pressure on Ukraine to accept a negotiation on territory, to accept no NATO for Ukraine, which means also probably no EU ever, because it will be a poisoned gift for EU to take Ukraine, because it will divide member states. EU doesn't have the capacity to take Ukraine. So they will be more and more divided, but they do mainly communication. And they are the losers because economically they switch from quite cheap.
Obviously, there's been no adults in the room when it came to this decision making here. Gentlemen, we have to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT.
Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays, on est en France quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, I'm going to ask all three of my questions, the same question here. I'll go to Daniel first. Daniel, I mean, you know, there's this talk, you know, should Ukraine get a negotiation? Who should back it? Who should be pushing it? Washington, London, the EU, all of this. But for me, this is all kind of small potatoes because, again, and the reason why we got here is that nobody's listening to what the Russians are saying. And the issue is not changed. Particularly since December 17th, when Russia sent its diplomatic notes or ultimata, however you want to define it, about Russia's own security relations with Europe. And this thing is not going to be over until that is addressed. And again, the West refuses to get involved in that conversation. That's what this is all about. Not about, you know, Zelensky at the Oscars and poor Ukrainians or starving Russians. It's not what this is about. It's about security arrangements in Europe. And Russia won't stop until it gets what it wants because it doesn't have good faith interlocutors. Daniel.
In that, you're absolutely right, Peter. And in that case, why would Russia stop at all? I mean, We're seeing facts established on the ground far beyond Donbass. We're seeing the integration into Russian economics, or economy and political structures of parts of Ukraine far beyond Donbass. So the idea that somehow Putin would negotiate away these facts on the grounds at this point, and someone pointed out, maybe it's you, Peter, Istanbul, I think that was the turning point, because beyond that, there's no point. We already see the effects of Russia turning its back on Donbass, so to speak, in 2014, and it made him very unpopular for a while in the region. So at this point, if he gives away the territorial gains that have been won by the Russian army to the benefit of the people in the region, and we've seen people on the ground celebrating and being happy in Mariupol, et cetera, then that is a huge political liability for Putin. At this point, why would he take such a huge downside with literally zero upside? What, a pat on the head from Blinken? That's going to make him happy? You know, sorry, I don't think so. There's no incentive for them to not keep going as far as they want.
Nebojsa, the same question. Daniel is absolutely right here. I mean, why should they give up what they already have in exchange for what? Okay? I mean, none of these people have any understanding of history or geopolitics. Go ahead.
Well, contrary to what the current leadership in the United States may believe, this is not 1990s Yugoslavia. Things are completely different, even though the U.S. is acting the same way. Putin is not, you know, the Russian army is not taking territory to give it back. For Russia, this is not a war of choice, as the Biden administration tried to frame it in a remarkable display of projection. It's an existential struggle. And if it wasn't on February 24th, it became so in the subsequent days through this whole obsession with arming Ukraine and making it a proxy war between Russia and the West. Russia calls it a special military operation. For Moscow, this is a police action. But for the West, it's World War III, but they don't dare actually fight it themselves. And so it has literally become an existential struggle. And so I don't think Russia is going to give up on it because they're aware of the stakes. I think what we need and what we're not getting is some kind of understanding in the West that this is so. And they don't have an off-ramp. They haven't thought this through to begin with. They have no victory conditions. They have no endgame plan. Their endgame plan was basically, we'll be mean to Russia and it will come groveling on its knees and surrender. Well, that hasn't worked and never will work. What's next? And they don't have the answer to that.
Pierre Emmanuel, speaking as a European, the talk about bringing in Ukraine into the EU, I find it really quite fanciful, particularly right now. What Ukraine? I mean, it's a failed state right now. What do they want to induct and why? And you as a European, are you interested in paying for that? Go ahead.
Well, in the European Union history, each country wanted to be at the center of the European Union for its own security. Like France at the beginning of the project was in the middle because there was West Germany on one side, Spain, Italy, and also Belgium and Netherlands on the north. And then Germany became the center of EU with enlargement of EU to the east. And then now Poland and the Baltic countries, they would like also not to be at the periphery, but to enlarge to Ukraine, also to have a buffer zone against Russia. But the problem is, if when EU working as it is now with its internal structure, Ukraine will make explode EU because our main of the money is spent on agricultural common policy, but also on regional funds, and it's unsustainable. And also there is a rivalry between Mediterranean member states who don't want Ukraine because it will suck all the money to the east, and Eastern Europeans would like to put all the money of EU on Ukraine. So it's not going to work at all.
You know, Daniel, if I go back to you here, I've long believed now, ever since Istanbul, is that the Russians will dictate the timetable and the terms of the end of the conflict. And we just have to wait for that. I find it really foolish on the part of Western analysts. You know, Russia suffered a defeat at Kyiv. Well, that presupposes that you knew what Russia's plans were. But nobody does, okay? And if you listen to the defense ministry briefings, which are really dry, and they never let anything out. They never tell you what they're up to. They just give you the number of items destroyed. It's very, you know, numerically driven, but they never tell you what their strategy is. But everybody on CNN knows what that strategy is. That's why they look like fools every single night. Go ahead, Daniel.
It's the Vietnam thing all over again, you know, and you have people like William Arkin, a supposed defense expert, writing a piece in Newsweek, I think yesterday, saying that, oh, yeah, Russia is taking over Severodonetsk, and but it doesn't mean anything. They're losing anyway, you know, so you have these hangers on. But what's interesting is just seeing the shift in European opinion. And there was an interesting recent survey done by the European Council on Foreign Relations, and they asked three questions. Are you in favor of peace, justice, or are you on the fence? Peace are the people who want this to end immediately, regardless of what it costs. Justice are people who want to keep going. And on the fence are people that sort of want both. Well, the plurality by a long shot, 33%, want to have peace. And that's the way things are going. I think that might be something behind the visit on Thursday of the leaders of France, Italy, and Germany to Kyiv, their surprise visit, showing solidarity with Ukraine. I wonder what really was said there. I wonder if this is more of a swan song than a new opening, because we know that Germany says, hey, we're going to send you some great tanks. And then they say, okay, this is great, but where's the ammo? Oh, well, that's going to come next year. You know, and this keeps happening over and over again. Hey, have some planes. They don't work, but here, you can have them. And, you know, calling up Raytheon, we need some new ones. We gave our crappy ones to Ukraine. You know, it's a money laundering scheme. Yep. And it's not working, and I think they're starting to sense this.
Yeah, you're so right. It's a money laundering operation. This is all this is. And plus, all the goodwill from the NATO country, they gave them junk that they didn't want anymore, okay? That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true here. Nebojsa, where does it go from here? Because if you look at the headlines, it's dropped, at least in the United States, for people. It's not the story that it was a few weeks ago, a couple months ago here. There seems to be a real quandary here. And plus, you know, a lot of people forget Zelensky, if he's kind of given the letdown, sorry, you know, but we did our best and all that, then the entire government will collapse because he can't stick around being a defeated leader. They don't understand. They pushed him up so much as a pop star, and now he has a long way to fall, Nebojsa.
He's got the world's biggest sense of entitlement. I have not seen anything like this, not even in the 1990s with U.S. proxies. But, you know, you had Biden himself the other day going, well, you know, he didn't listen to me when I told him. And I've heard it compared to Kennedy's famous quasi-denunciation of the Vietnamese president, Diem, right before Diem got overthrown in a coup. And we all know how that went for South Vietnam afterwards, and Kennedy himself later. The fact that the U.S. Media and political establishment started talking up January 6th recently, yep, as opposed, yep, to sticking with Ukraine.
That's right.
That was a dead giveaway to me that the Ukraine narrative is busted. It's done. You know, that particular ship has sailed. The war is lost. Call it whatever you will. The fact that the establishment is desperately flailing for a new narrative is showing that they're not actually winning. And I mean, not that anybody who's actually observing events on the ground seriously believe that at any point, but you know, all this talk that, you know, that whole Arkin piece, you know, pay no attention to Severodonetsk. There was a meme already, you know, pay no attention to Popasnaya, pay no attention to Kherson, pay no attention to, you know, you are here. And, you know, it goes all the way down to pay no attention to Kiev. I mean, it's, you know, what else has to happen for people to understand that the war on the ground is lost for the West and its proxies? It was lost on February 24th. It was lost on March 24th, and it will be lost on June 24th or July 24th, and so on and so forth. I don't think the French and the Germans are going to make a difference, though, because they're the ones who try to negotiate the end of Maidan, and we know how that ended. They're the ones who negotiated Minsk. We know how that ended. They're simply in agreement incapable at this point, and nobody's taking them seriously.
Pierre-Emmanuel, I mean, the biggest mistake, I mean, it's difficult to say the biggest mistake, but if the West had said, we must have peace in Ukraine, and not instead of saying they said, we must win, that was their biggest mistake, because they can't. Go ahead, in Brussels.
Yes, that's right. Western governments, because the people within Western member states think more and more differently, but the Atlantis governments, I would say, they think they still can promote their unipolar world to put Western values or rules or
rules-based order.
At the top of the world, but they cannot, because Russia, by intervening in Ukraine, is promoting a multipolar world, and by doing so, Ukraine will never be part of NATO. It will be very difficult to be part of EU as well, and means it's a retreat for Euro-Atlantic space, NATO and EU, and emergence of multipolarity. But it's very difficult for Western governments to accept this fact, because it will mean lose all their illusions, and they did so much propaganda before on this conflict.
Rapidly out of time, but you're absolutely right. Now, neoliberalism and the hubris of this ruling class, it'll all die in Ukraine the way they continue. And unfortunately, a lot of Ukrainians will continue dying. Unfortunately, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Brussels, and in Lake Jackson. And I want to thank my viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.